When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the Van Leer Institute series on ideas. I'm Renee Garfinkel. Today's conversation focuses on a classic and very timely book, The True Believer, Thoughts on the Nature of Mass Movements by Eric Hoffer. A stevedore on the San Francisco docks in the 1940s, Eric Hoffer wrote philosophical treatises in his spare time, while living in the railroad yards. The True Believer, his first and most famous book, was made into a bestseller when President Eisenhower cited it during one of the earliest television press conferences. Eric Hoffer was an autodidact, which is just one of the reasons I'm a fan. My guest today is Jay Garfinkel, author of the brand new book, Kohelet's Cocktail, Beyond the Pursuit of Happiness. It's a unique volume and beautiful volume of poetry and illustrations inspired by the Book of Ecclesiastes. Jay, welcome to the podcast.
Nice to be here, Renee. Thanks for inviting me.
Jay, as you know, Hoffer's interest in fanaticism began in the 1940s after World War II, when mass authoritarian movements of fascism and communism tore the world apart. Hoffer's breakthrough idea was that all mass movements, regardless of content, regardless of ideology, regardless of whether they're political, religious, or anything else, all mass movements appeal to the same type of individual because of their psychological profile. What do you think of that? Do beliefs matter to radical extremists, or is it really all about psychological dynamics?
Well, I think Hoffer was in the extreme when saying that mass movements, that is to say, the ideology of mass movements and what they profess, have no value to the person who's involved in the movement, other than that that person is acting out of a sense of desperation and hopelessness. Hoffer was not an academic. He did no research, and he really didn't know this. This comes from his own intuitions, that people act out of a sense of desperation and hopelessness. It could very well be that people do not act out of desperation and hopelessness, but because they are true believers in changing whatever it is they believe that needs change. So I think that there are some issues there. You know, he wasn't the only one to study the nexus between two opposite poles, which is Stalinism of Russia and Nazism. They were opposite because, in part, they're both totalitarian. It's true, but they believed in different things, and they were opposite because they were at war with one another during the Second World War. Hannah Arendt also studied those same issues. Coincidentally, both Hoffer and Hannah Arendt came out with their book in the same year, 1951. She gave a radically different idea to the nexus between, for example, Stalinism and Nazism. She said that these were unique totalitarian movements. Hoffer would have none of that. Of course, he knew her because they were both teaching at UCLA at the same time. And he himself said that while he likes her, he doesn't believe that her ideas are correct. She believed that the origin of totalitarianism came from the breaking apart of the order in which people lived. So, for example, the rural economy broke apart, and people had to move to the city. Well, there were many, many reasons, most of them economic in many ways, of how totalitarianism arose. But for Hopper, he really saw it as you mentioned, and you pointed that out, as all psychologically based, that extremist groups, he said, may have many traits in common, but regardless of the religious, political, and ideological point of view of organizations, their supporters draw from the same pool of frustrated individuals. And more importantly, Hoffer believed that it wasn't leadership that necessarily created a mass movement, because mass movements, he believed, came from the individual, that it was their need, their frustration, their wanting to change their life and their mental state. So I think that's what I think about Hoffer.
Well, I also have mixed feelings about Hoffer's argument that the particular group that an individual joins is just an accident of history, that the same individual could be a fascist if that was around in his culture or social world, or as have been a communist. Because when I think of it in modern times, could a progressive just as easily become a Proud Boy? Maybe the comparison is not apt, but it is the idea that that Hoffer maintains, which is that ideology is not the issue. Anybody who follows or is an extremist, a fanatic in whatever their system is, they could easily have been a religious fanatic instead of a political extremist. Now, okay, we're both skeptical about that, but it's an important point, because when you think about people who join cults, authoritarian parties, which is happening all over the world now, the idea that they all have something, let's say, missing in their psyche that is filled by the leader. And you were very skeptical about that. But I think there is something about the personalities of people who are ready to give up their own independent thinking in order to follow a leader that seems to have something in common. Do you agree?
I think I do agree, but I want to go to one quote of Hoffer, which is on point. He said, "Persons who hate themselves hate others. The killers of the world, literally and figuratively, are not known to be in loving relationships to their inner selves." I think there's a lot of truth in that. And Hoffer became very important now in the 21st century after 9/11, because it became the established text in the growing field of terrorism studies. Modern scholars have explored Hoffer's psychological model for a number of reasons. Chiefly, they want to explain why cultivating hatred for others or the other appears to be such a powerful weapon for terrorist organizations, and they use it in their attempt to recruit new members. So the analysts of modern-day global terrorism networks agree with Hoffer. They suggest that organizations that promote terror, the ones that we have currently in the 21st century, get significant mileage from redirecting people's inner feelings of frustration and channeling that hatred into the external enemy. And so from that point of view, Hoffer, I think, is correct. But there's an interesting opposite to this, because Hoffer provides a useful way for counter-terroristic scholars to explain why we can't reason with terrorists. Why can't you tell a terrorist what you're doing is really counterproductive, and don't be a terrorist? Why can't you do that? Because Hoffer would say people who join radical movements because of their low self-esteem, and he saw low self-esteem as being one of the motivators, will likely want to compensate for their failures by unconditionally following whatever cause they adopt. So as a result, most recent scholarship insists that we can't explain terrorism as merely a byproduct of, for example, Islamic fundamentalism. So I think in that regard, Hafa is extremely useful for 21st century people like ourselves trying to analyze these movements of terrorism.
Well, and one can replace faith in oneself with faith in the movement or faith in the leader. It's almost, although Hoffer doesn't say this, the other side of the lack of self-confidence and hopelessness in the followers is matched by the grandiosity and the narcissism of the leaders. When a leader says, the world is degraded, or those enemies across the river or across the world are against you, that leader, it's a he, because it seems always to be a male leader, says, only I can lead us to victory. Only I can solve it. Only I can fix it. And that allows the individual in the group, or an oppressed group that, as not just a bunch of individuals, but as an historical entity, has not succeeded in the ways that it thought it should, to look toward this leadership and this ideology as the solution to what they lack. It gives them purpose. It gives them self-worth. So it kind of does make sense. Happy, content, satisfied, positive people who have experienced some success in their life, are they not less likely to join an authoritarian movement?
I think people, it has been shown historically that very successful people, I'm thinking in particular of Germany during the interwar years, that gave rise to Nazism. Very successful people joined the Nazi movement and not only participated in it, but helped create its factories of destruction and extermination. All the very well-known Krupps and organizations we know of all participated in it. Another example would be France during World War II. You know, it was bureaucrats who were largely employed by the state, had good incomes, were never going to be impoverished. They joined forcefully in anti-democratic movements. So to answer your question, or I think you don't have to be impoverished socially. You don't have to have low self-esteem. You don't even have to be poor to join a mass movement. I think people can join of the kind that we're talking about, totalitarian movements. I think you can join it because you believe that your life will be better for having joined it than not having joined it. It's that old reinforcement contingency. Where do I think I'm going to be happier and gain? And by the way, I think you can fall in and you can fall out of movements, depending if you see that a movement is going downhill and you can switch sides very easily. So is that an ideological change or is that just a convenience? It's hard to say. I think it's a mixture of both.
Well, by bringing up the academics, professionals, and other Germans who were higher class, who subscribed to Nazism, you raise an important point, because perhaps it's different when the fringe group, when the extremism is a fringe group. For example, when an American or a Western European citizen travels halfway across the world to join ISIS. Maybe that is one kind of follower. Or when the movement dominates and even runs a country, as in Nazi Germany or Hamas in Gaza, Maybe there are two different phenomena, or the need for the idea that you need a rebirth, you need to be part of something greater than oneself, even in transcendence, something that inspires self-sacrifice, that has to do with other emotional factors besides, you know, or irrespective of economic and social standing. What do you think of that formulation?
I think it's pretty complex. People are complex, and because they are complex, that formulation, along with maybe Hoffer's, that tries to reduce things to data points, are not always correct. I think one of the issues of change, why people become part of a movement, whether it's a religious movement or a political movement, is because their friends are doing it too. One of the things that you just pointed to is interesting to me. When we have an issue going on in social media, if you go on social media, or TikTok or in the others, there seems to be something in groupthink. Now, if you take individuals and you ask them individually, what do you think of this issue? What do you think of democracy? What do you think of this person who wants to be an elected leader? Well, so I think if you speak to them individually, you're going to get one kind of a response. But if you ask collectively in social media, you're going to get what I would consider, and I think Hoffer would probably consider, social media was not present when he was alive. But there is that movement that occurs because others are doing it too. And I think we never really speak about that enough, or have examined it enough, about the effect of wanting to be part of a group. Now, I say social media because I think that's a 21st century opportunity for people to live collectively as an idea. But, you know, mass rallies in the 1930s, demonstrations, anti-war demonstrations in the 1960s, freedom movements for African Americans during the 60s and the 70s, all of those, and demonstrations, of course, did they radicalize people? Yes, they did. But did people emerge with a collective idea because they wanted to be part of the group? I think it was, which is not to say that any of those things were groupthink, but there is something about being part of a collective and being part of the winning team. And you have it even in high schools, you know, people band together. There is the ins and the outs of every group, and people want to be part of the ins and not part of the outs, because being part of the ins makes you feel good. It makes you feel part of something. And what do you say? You know a lot about that, about the dynamics of wanting acceptance and being part of a group.
Well, certainly that has a role once a group is operating. People want to belong. People want to fit in. It's really a very fundamental need. We gather in groups from the beginning, from families, through communities, through political parties, and every other level. But surely, if all your friends are in a cult, your chances of joining the cult are high. But there's more than social contagion in what the choice of the group is. You could join a group that wants to clean up the river, or a group that wants to meet politically for environmental reasons, or you can join a group that is hostile, aggressive, and negative. So you may want to join, but whether this particular kind of authoritarian group will satisfy you, I think there are distinctions. And you know, one of the reasons why I thought this was a good time to take a second look at The True Believer, which I originally read a million years ago, is that some of the circumstances that Hoffer talks about, well, first of all, there are populist, authoritarian movements, extremist and violent movements gaining power and followers all over the world right now. But I was particularly concerned with the correspondence between some of the things Hoffer points out and what the data on mental health in the United States reveals. There's been a lot of writing about it, rising rates of anxiety, depression, people not getting jobs or getting married in the usual developmental times, and having a lot of anxiety about whether the world will continue to spin on its axis and be livable. So I wonder, looking at it through Hoffer's lens, is the U.S. ripe for extremist movements? And does that have something to do with the way politics is working out in America now?
Well, there would have to be somebody let's start from just taking an aerial view instead of looking just at the present. The United States, in particular, has always had countercultural movements or movements where people have declared that it's the end of the United States as we know it. We are all old enough to remember the burning of the cities in the 1960s during the Civil Rights Movement and the anti-Vietnam War protests were extremely violent in so many ways. And that was part of what I would call mass movements that were trying to deconstruct the social order of the United States in the 60s and the 70s and even into the part of the 80s. And I think that was more dangerous than what we're seeing in the United States today. What we see in the United States today is that the country is split 50-50 between those who want one political party and those who want a second political party, another political party. And yet, both of them believe in democracy, believe that elected officials have to come not through force, and don't seek the destruction of the country. They seek different they have the outcomes, but they don't seek the destruction of the country. So I'm not as negative about what's going on in the United States as I had been during the 60s and 70s. I actually thought in the 60s and 70s that the American experiment of democracy was going to be over. But it was not over, because it's a very, very strong democratic values, which have been upheld generation after generation. So I think that's quite different.
So that's a good point to continue on, because some of the things that we're talking about are morally neutral. For example, the desire to fit in, the desire for approval from your peers, the wish to be inspired to make the world better than it's ever been, all of those are not necessarily bad. They don't have to lead to fanaticism. And Hoffer talks about that a little bit. He mentions that these psychological dynamics can spark mass extremist movements that are good.
Although he was against all of them. I mean, one of the great critiques of Hoffer was that he opposed the civil rights movement, he opposed the free speech movement, he opposed the anti-war protests, And for that, his book fell out of favor.
But in his book, he mentions Lincoln and Gandhi as two examples of and their followers as two examples of mass movements following big, giant leaders that did not end up and would not end up in violent fanaticism. And he writes a little bit, I wish he had written some more, about what the difference is between those leaders who harness the power of followers for good and those who harness it for the opposite. Do you remember that?
No, I don't, sorry.
Now, he pointed out that both Abraham Lincoln and Gandhi were willing and able to end the movement when their objective was more or less achieved. So once slavery was abolished, Lincoln didn't need to have to rally the country behind him just to maintain power. And similarly with Gandhi, he had specific objectives that were different from the leaders that true believers follow, in that the goals were objective. They were, what shall I say? They were not messianic. They didn't try to change the whole world. They just tried to achieve their defined objectives. And also, as individuals, they were willing to give up power,
But
which in the authoritarian movements, and we know in history, are aimed at keeping the leaders in power.
but when it came to the civil rights movement, he accused the African American community of failing to build communal institutions. And he saw because they had failed to do something about the situation that they were in, of using the civil rights movement as almost akin to a totalitarian movement, as a violent movement. I think he was very harsh when it came to the civil rights movement.
So, what do you think? Did he misinterpret it, misunderstand it? I mean, it is one thing to write a theoretical book and another thing to observe something going on in your world. What do you think happened? Would he?
I think Hoffa was not a systematic thinker with a systematic set of ideas. So one of the areas in which I think that this is pronounced is that he never precisely gave a definition to what a mass movement is. He picked mass movements here, but he didn't pick mass movements there. And because there was no real accurate definition of what a mass movement is, what makes, for example, he talked about the Zionist movement, what makes that a mass movement? Whereas he also talked about the Zulus and fighting against the South Africans. Are they both the same? Is Zionism and because he has no, there was no ever, he's not a systematic thinker, so we never really know what is a mass movement, and that is very problematic. Is the anti-war movement, is the women's movement a movement, a radical movement? I don't know. Maybe it's just people that want change, and that I think is the big problem with Hoffa and trying to take many of his ideas and bring them to the fore to the 21st century, because he's so porous, we could maybe use him forever. We want to see him. In the end, though, I think his big accomplishment was saying that a person joins a movement because of their own psychological need or failings. And it's not specific to an ideology. A person can go from one movement to another movement if that movement satisfies his psychological need. I think there's a certain truth to what he said there.
And that's a great point for us to end on. True Believer is an old-fashioned but very accessible book on a highly important topical subject. Thanks so much for taking the time to be on this podcast with me, Jay.
Happy to be here.
And thanks, as always, to Bela Pasikov.